Let's get our Bibles open to 1 Kings chapter number 3, where we're going to begin with verse number 16. This is all taking place in the opening weeks of King Solomon's solo reign. Now, I'm of the opinion that this is taking place in his fourth year on the throne since David put him there. But David has just recently died, and now Solomon is becoming acknowledged as the singular king. Now, of course, after his father's funeral and the mourning that went with that, we know that Solomon went up to the high place at Gibeon, the place where the tabernacle designed and built by Moses was located. And he offered a whole bunch of sacrifices in praise and honor to God. And that night he was given a dream where God said, "I'll give you whatever you ask. What do you want?" And Solomon's request as a young man was, "I need wisdom. I need to know how to lead this numerous people of Israel." And God's response was, "That's what I'm going to give you." But he also said, "I'm going to give you wealth, and I'm going to give you power and all sorts of fame." So that's all taken place recently. And Solomon is back at the capital city of Jerusalem. He is in the palace of David. He is sitting on the throne, and this happens. 1 Kings 3:16. "Then two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him." Now, I always mention when we come to this story that the word prostitute here may be a little bit too strong of an English word. Yes, there were, as has almost always been the case in societies, women and men, actually, who hired themselves out as sex workers. But this word is, it's actually two words in the Hebrew and two words in the Greek, literally means women of illegal sexual activity. Now, that doesn't always mean for sale. A woman or a man who was sleeping with someone they were not married to would be described as someone engaging in illicit sexual activity. And so, in my opinion, I think that this is less about two ladies of the night and more about two unwed mothers. Two women who ended up pregnant. Their baby mamas or their baby fathers apparently ran off, and they are living together to try to share expenses and stuff. That is what I think is happening here. Okay, my opinion. Let's move forward now with the wording of the text. So these two women of illicit sexuality came to the king and they stood before him. Now remember, the king is the ultimate judicial authority. And so it would appear that they've already been through a couple of levels of local judicial review. And no one, as of yet, have figured out how to solve their problem, their dispute. So it comes to David. The one woman said, "Oh, my Lord, this woman and I live in the same house. I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. And then on the third day after I gave birth, this woman also gave birth, and we were alone." All right, so we've got two women, both pregnant, sharing a house, probably sharing expenses out of necessity. One has a baby. Third day later, the other has the baby. Nobody else around. So there's no dads in the picture. No parents, grandparents, nobody else. It's just these two ladies. There was no one else with us in the house. Only we two were in the house. This woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. And unfortunately, that does happen from time to time as an accident. Doctors, medical professionals tell new mothers, don't sleep with your baby in the bed with you. You need to keep the baby in the crib away, right? That sort of thing. So this woman apparently rolled over, smothered her child. Verse 20. She arose at midnight and took my son from beside me while your servant slept and laid him at her breast and laid her dead son at my breast. Now this is the woman's accusation, is that in the middle of the night while I was asleep and didn't know what was going on, this woman substituted her dead baby for my living baby. So when I rose in the morning to nurse my child, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him closely in the morning, behold, he was not the child that I had born. So the babies are not very old. They're newborns. But mom knows what her baby looks like. And while she thought at first her baby was dead, upon closer looking at the child's body, she realizes, this is not my baby. And so the other woman jumps in at this point in the trial. No, the living child is mine. The dead child is yours. And the first said, no, the dead child is yours. The living child is mine. And thus they spoke before the king. And so the king said, the one says, this is my son that is alive. Your son's dead. The other says, no, but your son is dead and my son is living. Got a problem in the law. The Jewish principle is, in the mouth of two or three witnesses, let every matter be established. So it takes two witnesses for a judge to feel confident about an event. Well, here they've got two witnesses, but each witness tells a different story. It's a she said, she said. And so there is not enough information here to make a judicial decision. That's why it's probably been bumped up to David. Not David, excuse me, Solomon. And so Solomon says, bring me a sword. Now that probably surprised everybody. Remember, Solomon is probably right around his upper teens. He became king when he was in his, I think, mid-teens, and then 3.5 or so years under David before David dies. I believe he was still under the majority Israeli age of 20 whenever his father died and he became king, in part because Solomon, in his prayer to God, says, I am but a child. So he was thinking himself as a minority person. So anyway, back to the story. Think of Solomon being about 19. So he says, bring me a sword. Now that might have been a big surprise to everybody. What? What does he want a sword for? So a sword was brought before the king. And the king said, divide the living child in two. Give half to the one, half to the other. Now that's a shock. I mean, even me knowing the story, after decades of knowing the story and telling it, it still catches me in the heart. It's like, what? And that's when the woman whose son was alive said to the king, because her heart yearned for her son, oh, my Lord, give her the living child. By no means put him to death. But the other said, he's going to be neither mine nor yours. Go ahead and divide him. And that's exactly what Solomon was looking for. He by God's wisdom, understood that true love, true commitment, such as a mother to her child, would sacrifice relationship with that child if that's what it took to save the child's life. And so the moment that the woman said, I know, don't do that. Let her have the baby. Solomon knew. Now, of course, the bitterness of the other woman comes through as a secondary proof that she was not the mom of the living child, because she was quite willing for both mothers to be grieving. And so Solomon has figured it out. So the king answered and said, "Give the living child to the first woman. By no means put him to death. She is his mother." And so even to this day, this is kind of thrown out there as an example of Solomonic wisdom. Just something so simple, but no one had thought about it until this point as a means of unraveling this problem. And so verse 28 says, "All Israel heard of the judgment of the king that he had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king, because they perceived that the wisdom of God was in him to do justice." So this is put out there as the first public demonstration of young King Solomon's new God-given wisdom. And everybody is super impressed by it. And this is just representative of what else is to come. Now, 1 Kings chapter 4, we're going to skip over it at this point, because I believe a lot of the information in here comes from later in Solomon's kingdom. So we're going to put it on the back burner until we get a little farther into the kingdom. Chapter number 5 of 1 Kings needs to be paralleled up with 2 Chronicles chapter number 2. And this is where we're going to start building the king, the palace of God, the temple of God. If you can keep both places open, that'd be great. 2 Chronicles 2:1 says, "Solomon proposed to build a temple for the name of He who is, and a royal palace for himself." So the chroniclers are letting us know that he's got big building plans getting ready to happen. 1 Kings 5 says, "Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon when he heard that they had appointed him king in place of his father, for Hiram always loved David." So this again matches the idea that King David just recently died, and Solomon is now the solo king. And so Hiram, who has great relationships with David, reaches out to the son of David and congratulates him on his new leadership solo adventure. Verse 2, "Solomon sent word to Hiram, 'You know that David, my father, could not build a house for the name of He who is his God because of the warfare with which his enemies surrounded him, until He who is put them under the soles of his feet.'" Now, this is interesting, Solomon's verbal take on the reason why David was not permitted to build the temple. We know from earlier testimony that when David first occupied Jerusalem, he wanted to build the temple, but God told him, "No, you are a man of blood. You are a man of warfare. The temple will be built by one of your descendants who is a man of peace." And so David basically had blood on his hands personally and corporately as the leader of the kingdom. And so he's not allowed to build God's palace. It has to be someone who has not been involved in warfare. So here is Solomon talking to Hiram about this, saying, you know that my dad had to fight in order to stabilize the kingdom, to get the kingdom to the full extent of the promised land given by God. And because of that warfare, he was not allowed to build the temple. But now, verse number 4, he who is my God has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor misfortune. David handed over to Solomon a peaceful kingdom. You know, there were some problems there at the tail end with the whole Ammonite problems and then the Aramean problems. And then we ended up with Absalom, and then we ended up with the Sheba, and then we ended up with a Philistine uprising. So there was some problems there in those last few years of David's kingdom, but even those got resolved enough that when David died, Solomon took over a peaceful kingdom, a kingdom that stretched from the Gulf of Aqaba all the way up to the Euphrates River, from the Mediterranean coast over to Ammon and Moab and the highway of the kings in that region. So all of the promised land plus was handed over into Solomon's hands, and it's at peace. And so now he says to Hiram, verse 5, so I intend to build a house for the name of he who is my God, as he who is said to David, my father, your son, whom I will set on your throne in your place, shall build the house for my name. So Solomon says, I'm the fulfillment of God's promise that a peaceful son, remember Shlomo, Solomon's name in Hebrew means peaceful. I am the peaceful heir of a peaceful kingdom, and now I'm ready to build the temple to he who is that made all of that possible. And then he makes this request, verse number 6. Now therefore, command that cedars of Lebanon be cut for me, and my servants will join your servants, and I will pay you for your servants such wages as you set, for you know that there is no one among us who knows how to cut timber like the Sidonians. So the Sidonians, the Tyre people, were Phoenicians. And since ancient times, the Phoenicians were known as shipbuilders and large building builders, and they used the lumber that comes from the cedars of Lebanon to do a lot of that building. And so it's the perfect place from which to gather such things. If you remember, Hiram gifted a palace to King David when he first moved into Jerusalem. So the very palace that Solomon is sitting in as he's having this communication back and forth was built with Tyrian or Sidonian or Phoenician laborers using materials from cedars of Lebanon. And so the request is made to Hiram, can you help me out here in the building of this palace for God that I already have the designs for from my father? Let me read to you from 2 Chronicles 2, the parallel that describes this. This is 2 Chronicles 2, 3. Solomon sent word to Hiram, the king of Tyre, as you dealt with David, my father, and sent him cedar to build himself a house to dwell in, so deal with me. Behold, I am about to build a house for the name of He who is my God, and dedicate it to Him for the burning of incense of sweet spices before Him, and for the regular arrangement of the showbread, and for burnt offerings morning and evening, on the Sabbaths, on the new moons, on the appointed feasts of He who is our God, as ordained forever for Israel. So, very specific. I want to build this religious gathering center that will be used every single day throughout the year to give glory and honor and praise to our God. Verse 5, the house that I am to build will be great, for our God is greater than all gods. I'm curious as to how Hiram may have taken that, because every indication is that Hiram is a polytheist. He is a believer in multiple gods. He probably was quite open to the idea of the Israeli God being powerful, supporting David, but he would have thought of the Israeli God as being one of many gods. But here's Solomon saying, my God is over any god that might be out there, any wannabes. Verse number 6, but who is able to build him a house, since heaven, even highest heaven, cannot contain him? Solomon always understood that the building was symbolic of God's reign. God was not going to be limited to this little structure in Israel. Who am I to build a house for him except as a place to make offerings before him? So he makes this point that I'm a young kid, I am a man, who am I to be involved in such an important project? Then he makes this request. So now send me a man skilled to work in gold, silver, bronze, and iron, and in purple, crimson, and blue fabrics, trained also in engraving, to be the skilled workers who are with me in Judah and Jerusalem, whom David my father provided. Send me also cedar, cypress, and algum timber from Lebanon, for I know that your servants know how to cut timber in Lebanon, and my servants will be with your servants to prepare timber for me in abundance, for the house I am to build will be a great and wonderful house. So David doesn't just simply ask for material. He says, I also need professional design work. I've got the basic blueprints, I've got the basic design work, but I need somebody that will make it spectacular. And I know someone from within your group would certainly fit that bill. Now he then offers financial support for the Lebanese workers, the people working in the area of the Lebanon mountains to bring this material together. And so he says this, verse 10, I will give to your servants, the woodsmen who cut timber, 20,000 cores of crushed wheat. Now, that doesn't compute with us. That's a Hebrew description. It's basically 120,000 bushels of wheat every single year. That's 3,429 tons of wheat, if that helps. How about this? 32 train cars full of wheat. That's a lot of wheat. And he's going to give this every single year to the woodsmen that are cutting and preparing the stuff to send it south. 20,000 cores of barley. So wheat's a little bit more expensive grain. Barley is the common grain, but he's going to send just as much as that. 20,000 baths of wine. That's 120,000 gallons of wine every year that's going to be sent up there. And then 20,000 baths of oil, so 120,000 gallons of olive oil. So this is this is going to be basic rations for these woodsmen to live off of while they're cutting and preparing for transport all of the lumber. And this is received by Hiram with joy. Hiram, the king of Tyre, answered in a letter that he sent to Solomon, because he who has loves his people, he's made you king over them. Hiram also said, blessed be he who is the God of Israel, who made heaven and earth, who has given King David a wise son, who has discretion and understanding, who will build a temple for he who is, and a royal palace for himself. And so positive things said by Hiram about God there. But even with that, I have my suspicions that he remained a polytheist. But he is complimentary of Solomon, being a man after his father's own heart, and that this will be a grand project. And then, in the last moments before we finish today, let's hear about the guy that Hiram's going to send to oversee all the design elements. Verse 13, now I have a skilled man who has understanding, Huram Abi, the son of a woman of the daughters of Dan, and his father was a man of Tyre. So he is half Israeli, half Phoenician. Apparently mom and dad met up there in the north country. He is trained to work in gold, silver, bronze, iron, stone, wood, and in purple, blue, and crimson fabrics and fine linen, and to do all sorts of engraving and execute any design that may be assigned him, along with your craftsmen, the craftsmen of my lord, David, your father. So it's going to be a half Israeli that functions like Belzeal did for Moses. And so we have a professional overseeing the design work.